The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering iPhone and iPad repairs, including liquid damage, cracked screens, failing batteries, and other issues. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, once again from WGBH in Boston, on my way to Vermont. But we want to report this hour on some unsightly realities in politics and in the global implications of an aviation tragedy. Candidates trying to cover their identity struggles literally with whole cloth. On Capitol Hill, the House is apparently one very serious carpet shampoo and office fumigation away from a very new way of doing business. But toss out the polls, we have actual election results from yesterday's voting around the country. And there are clues and hints of many issues and impulses for American voters which could be relevant for 2016. At the top of the list, a conservative resurgence in Texas and Kentucky this week. Houston voters rejected the city's equal rights ordinance, championed by Anise Parker, the city's first openly lesbian mayor. It was a civil rights ordinance that became, in the end, all about bathrooms. Here's Republican Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick on KRPC television.
It's just common sense and common decency. We don't want men in women's ladies' rooms. This had nothing to do with equal rights. We already have equal rights guaranteed under our Constitution.
That Houston ordinance lost by a significant margin. But over in Kentucky, conservative upstart, but familiar name by now, Matt Bevin, who tried to bring down Senator Mitch McConnell back in 2014, made it this time by party skeptics and Kentucky pollsters. By winning 53% of the vote to become governor, the first time a Republican has taken the state house in Frankfort in quite a while.
Whether you voted for me, whether you didn't vote for me, whether you voted or didn't vote, this is your Kentucky. This is your America. This is our opportunity to come together as one.
The opportunity for Kentuckians, according to Republican Governor-elect Matt Bevin in his victory speech. But what's the opportunity for Bevin himself? Joining us is Ryland Barton, Capitol Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. What do you think, Ryland? How much of a surprise was this? And is this a stepping stone for Matt Bevin?
It was a pretty huge surprise in Kentucky. All the polls were showing the Democratic candidate Jack Conway ahead by about 5 percentage points. He had held a lead just about the entire summer. But Bevin sprinted to the finish either by going around bad polling or by getting out the vote at the last minute. Conway was unable to rally the votes he needed, especially in the urban areas in Kentucky.
Do you think there was a Davis effect, Matt Bevin taking advantage of Democrats who maybe aren't terribly thrilled with the liberalization on gay marriage in Kentucky?
I think by the time Election Day came around, Kim Davis wasn't so much a part of the conversation, but it certainly did set the scene for the campaign over the course of the summer. Bevin, he was backed by Kim Davis. He also went to visit her when she was spent that 5-day stint in jail. So, I mean, that was a real rallying cry for social conservatives in Kentucky. And if you're looking for ways to paint the increasingly red state of Kentucky, that's certainly a big flashpoint in the pan.
A lot of comparisons being made between Matt Bevin and Donald Trump now that Donald Trump has had his surprise resurgence here in the presidential campaign. Do you buy those comparisons?
I buy those comparisons when it comes down to Bevin's. He can be pretty off the cuff. He can be pretty confrontational, almost inadvertently. He spars with reporters a lot. He'll just kind of speak his mind. He's very unscripted.
Does that mean he is visionless? Does he have an agenda, a specific vision for Kentucky, as previous governors have recently had in Kentucky, particularly about Obamacare?
He's had a pretty specific agenda on a few conservative principles, the top of the list being right-to-work legislation. He really wants to pass that in Kentucky. That's legislation that forbids unions from requiring union members to pay dues as a condition of employment, and some other conservative principles as well. I mean, he's when it comes down to Kim Davis, he wants to pass a law that would not require clerks to have to issue marriage licenses if they don't want to, basically pulling the state out of the marriage license business. Also wanting to repeal the state's Medicaid expansion. The expansion of the state added about 400,000 Kentuckians to the Medicaid rolls over the last few years, and he says that the state can't afford to pay that as the federal subsidies for that system start to dwindle down over the next few years.
You mentioned the right-to-work mission of Matt Bevin. Does he fancy himself another
Scott Walker, or is he more a Tea Party candidate?
I think that union leaders are trying to paint him as a Scott Walker, as being very anti-union. I think that the stats that right-to-work supporters, including Bevin, like to point to are that they say that union membership is up in states that have taken on right-to-work legislation. So he definitely portrays himself as a Tea Partier. He's just very anti-establishment, anti-regulation, anti-big anything. So he's just trying to drive forward to rally up the conservative and a kind of free market base in Kentucky.
Well, it's his moment in the sun in a off-year election. Ryland Barton, do you think Bevin has national aspirations?
I mean, he ran for Senate last year against Senator Mitch McConnell and lost that race big. Talking to people who know him well, they say, you know, he's a real family man. He's got 9 children, all of whom are still in high school and middle school and elementary school. So he seems to say that he wants to stick around Kentucky. It's unclear if he has national aspirations, although I wouldn't put that outside of the realm of possibility.
Ryland Barton, Capital Bureau Chief for Kentucky Public Radio. Thanks so much, Ryland.
Thanks for having me.
Can the huge gulf between China and Taiwan ever be bridged? A gulf forged in war, sustained by the Cold War, and mutual denial for decades, but suddenly it's in a state of historic flux. Delivering a shocker not so far away from, say, discovering North Korea's Kim Jong-un in a K-pop club in Seoul this weekend, the leaders of China and Taiwan will meet in Singapore for the first time since 1949, and the first time ever as separate nations. The news comes as Taiwanese President Ma Ying-jeou faces a long-shot re-election campaign and after a difficult few months for Chinese President Xi Jinping, facing China's economic downturn and a stock market plunge over the summer. Austin Ramsey, reporter for our partner in the New York Times, says everything about this meeting is unusual, from the understated expectations to what each of these leaders will actually call each other.
I think this in some ways goes against the public sentiment. I don't think that there's a real demand on the part of the Taiwanese people in general that this meeting go through. And I think there are some concerns that about what could happen. It sounds like there won't be any agreements made, but it also seems like the Taiwanese people are just sort of uncertain about what might happen.
We can say with some certainty that nobody's going to call the other a bandit, probably, in this meeting. And that of bitterness is probably going to be ignored. China is very keen to have what's going on in the South China Sea ignored. Is that likely to happen?
Yes, I think at least in this meeting, and my sense is that it's not an issue that either side would want to bring up in that forum. I think they are trying to find points of agreement or points of commonality.
Does a meeting like this turn the United States, who, you know, began this century as Taiwan's great benefactor, and certainly since 1949 has been the ally who, you know, Taiwan has relied on more than any outside of the Pacific, has it made the United States more of an irrelevant bystander here, or put pressure on the United States to show its bona fides in terms of protecting Taiwan's security right now?
I think in terms of Taiwan and China, the main U.S. interest is to not have a headache, to not have China sailing ships in the Taiwan Strait in a threatening manner, or not have sort of standoffs that can lead to armed conflict. So the comments from Washington have been very measured, but very sort of wait and see. But I think in general, as long as this is something that lowers tensions, I think it's something that the U.S. government will welcome.
Well, measured is absolutely right here. Here's Defense Secretary Ash Carter speaking about the South China Sea and speculating about how important an issue that might be in these Taiwan-China talks. Listen.
The United States does not take sides in these maritime disputes, but we do take the side of peaceful resolution under international law.
Does anyone believe that this meeting in some way envisions a peaceful resolution, finally, of the Taiwan-China question? Or is it just a meeting in a parade of meetings that could go on endlessly?
I don't think anyone envisions this is the end or anywhere near the end. It's certainly a historic moment. The head of the People's Republic of China and the head of the Republic of China, or Taiwan, have never met. So it will be a historic moment. But the expectations are quite low. The Taiwan side has already said that there will be no agreements made. There won't be a joint statement. And even if they wanted to try and reach some sort of accord with China, it's the sort of thing that the legislature and Taiwan would likely block. So it doesn't seem like there will be any sort of breakthrough. But at the same time, it will create a sort of a benchmark in the future. The ruling party, which is likely to be defeated in the upcoming elections, can say we reached this level of closeness with Beijing. So I think it will stand out from a historic perspective, but I don't think there will be any breakthrough.
I can't resist asking you a language question, the language about where the, or what the Taiwanese leader is doing is fairly clear. But where is and what is the Chinese leader doing? I mean, Taiwan technically is a province of China. I mean, is he taking a trip to, Rhode Island, or is he taking a trip to Mars?
Well, the meeting will be held in Singapore, which is a country that both sides have close relationship with. But it is a bit interesting in terms of by having it in that place, it creates this sort of it makes it quite difficult in terms of protocol, and China will be a great pains to make it seem that President Xi Jinping is not meeting with the president of a sovereign nation, and it seems like they've already reached some agreements in advance, and it sounds like they will just call each other Xinsheng in Chinese or Mister in English. So they're doing away with the question of should we call each other President or General Secretary or what the titles are.
A tiny linguistic question that speaks volumes. Austin, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Austin Ramsey is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times, based in Beijing. The late Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher changed British history, but that doesn't mean anyone these days cares to rummage through her closet.
Is there anything here, Prime Minister, that your husband particularly likes?
Well, yes, he loves the colours, and he loves the pretty clothes, you know, so much I am in very tailored clothes. And he loves this one, for example. It's colour, and it has just a little bit more prettiness, and we did concentrate on really rather nice buttons. And so when I came out in this, he said, oh, thank goodness, because sometimes he says, oh, not black again, dear.
Well, this week, the Victoria and Albert Museum in London told the Baroness Thatcher estate that it was not interested in exhibiting former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher's wardrobe. The museum reportedly said it tries to focus on acquiring clothing about standing, aesthetic, or technical quality. Ouch. Apparently, punk-era bondage suits designed by Vivienne Westwood are fine for the V&A. Now more than 300 Thatcher items, including presumably quite a few all-black ensembles, as well as some of the Prime Minister's husband's more colorful favorites, will be sold in an auction at Christie's instead. More on the historic pantsuits of powerful women later this hour. Stay with us.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. Learn more at TIAA.org.
Here at WGBH in Boston, you toss a pebble and chances are it lands in the parking lot of a seafood restaurant. Down by the waterfront where my hotel is, the smell of fish and a much-reduced fishing fleet can still be seen in the harbor. Toss a pebble in a different direction around here, and you will land on a college campus where some of the finest research institutions in the world are researching climate change, marine biology, and the changing ocean. For the first time, the impact of all of these can be seen in the weather in New England, on the plates of New Englanders, and in the industries of this region. The double whammy of climate change and overfishing has produced a welcome surprise for some in the lobster industry and an alarming crash in the fish population of the once wildly abundant cod and haddock stocks. Heather Goldstone, science correspondent for WCAI and WGBH Radio, says cod in particular are in trouble, and they, the fish that is, can apparently feel it.
A host of researchers from several different organizations around New England went and looked and said, so we've seen this rapid decline in the past few years, despite the fact that we've been cutting back on fishing pressure. They should have been rebounding, and instead they're declining even faster. So could warming water temperatures be part of that? And in fact, the Gulf of Maine, this area of waters off of New England's coast from north of Cape Cod all the way up to the Canadian border, has been warming faster than 99% of the rest of the ocean. So could that be a factor? Well, in fact, we know that it probably is a factor. But what they did in this case is they kind of looked backward and said, if we look at these populations numbers and we take temperature into account, it explains this decline much better. And the problem is that fishery managers didn't do that. And so they allowed fishing or set fishing limits based on an assumption of what the cod population used to be without these impacts of warming, and essentially allowed overfishing.
Now, are cod anadromous fish like salmon or steelhead or something like that, in which case, if it gets warmer, they just move to somewhere where it's colder, and you know that may be unfortunate to one town, but to another part of the world, it's a fine thing. The ocean is big.
Yeah, cod are not necessarily migratory. They're not moving up rivers, but they do have the ability to move. The first time I actually reported on a fishery story in 2009, the story was that government fishery scientists were reporting that over half of all commercially exploited fish species, so not just cod, were shifting where they were found in the ocean in order to try to stay within their temperature comfort zone.
What do the fishermen say?
Fishermen are definitely noticing changes. And again, it's not just cod. The lobster fishery in southern New England, you might have heard in Gulf of Maine, lobster is going great guns. We've actually had gluts in the past few years. That may be in part because water temperatures have risen and given them a little boost there. But in southern New England, Cape Cod over toward Long Island, the temperatures are so warm that the population has collapsed. One of the most dramatic examples I've encountered in recent years was a weir fisherman in Chatham, Massachusetts, named Ernie Eldridge. And weir fishing, weirs are these round nets held in place by wooden poles. It's a style of fishing that goes back thousands of years to Native Americans. And they've been fishing in these same places in the same way. And so they're in a really good position to see changes. And Ernie says that they've seen dramatic changes in recent years.
You know, they've been traveling these same areas, you know, for as long as we've known. And we've just seen it change over the past probably 10 to 15 years. We've seen a change. And probably over the past 6 or 7 years, we've seen a dramatic change.
You know, Eldridge says that he used to catch a host of different kinds of fish and that they're just not there yet. He's considering getting out of the business and that sometimes when they do catch fish, what they're actually catching are more southerly species that they've never even seen in New England before.
You talked earlier about this combination of factors, the fishing and the temperature warming in the waters. Does this mean that we no longer can just use pure fish and catch calculations as a way of controlling the fish and that we really have to, from now on, take all these factors into consideration?
It really does. And that's actually something that a whole range of scientists, environmentalists, and fishermen have been talking about for years. Understatement of the year, the ocean is complicated. Right. And so when we go to build a model and try to gauge how many fish there are and how many we can sustainably catch, what scientists have tended to do is simplify and say, well, we think the biggest factor driving this is how much we fish. Steve Cadron of UMass Dartmouth School of Marine Science and Technology says that up until about a decade ago, that assumption of a constant environment or being able to ignore the environment worked for managers, but that it doesn't work anymore.
We have such profound changes, not only in temperature. I think temperature is what most people see, but really in our circulation patterns, in the oceanography, there are really profound and multiple changes that are happening in our ecosystem.
And so if a more realistic calculation was made, what's that going to look like, given the fact that it's going to be positive on some people, like lobstermen who you referred to?
Well, for the moment, the Gulf of Maine cod fishery is all but shut down. The southern New England lobster fishery is all but shut down and has been intermittently for a few years. But these could come back. And in other cases, there is actually the possibility of new fisheries.
Are lobster going to be abundant from here on out?
Well, that depends on where you are. cod are moving north, lobster are moving north. For the moment, lobster are very abundant in the Gulf of Maine.
Does that mean they're climate deniers if they're if they're in the midst of abundance?
No, actually, scientists have always said that with climate change, there will be winners and losers, and there will at least be some temporary winners. Lobster right now are very happy in the Gulf of Maine. Cod fishermen farther north up to Greenland are looking at maybe having more cod up there, but we're not looking at having as much cod here in New England.
Complicated ocean, but not optimism.
Not a lot of optimism. You know, there's a real mix, but under this most recent study for cod, at least, shows that under moderate warming, we could see a reasonable recovery in 10 to 20 years, depending on fishing pressure, but that under a more extreme warming scenario, we're looking at definitely a decreased, if sustainable, fishery.
Heather Goldstone, science correspondent for WGBH and WCII. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The growing visibility of climate change combined with depressed oil prices means the proposed Keystone XL pipeline is looking more vulnerable than ever. TransCanada, the oil producer from its tar sands project, has asked the White House to hold off on approving the project while they wait to see if Nebraska approves the proposed route. Landowners in the state have been at the forefront of the fight against Keystone, and their position is stronger than ever since the expense of producing oil from tar sands at global oil prices around $40 a barrel makes Keystone a dubious business proposition right now. The pipeline's fate could easily be in the hands of the next occupant of the White House, but even a pro-oil Republican might not be able to save it at this point. Jack Cushman, writer for the Inside Climate News and author of Keystone and Beyond, Tar Sands and the National Interest in the Era of Climate Change, says the project is beginning to look a little bit like a pipeline to nowhere.
The project is really facing what the whole fossil fuel industry is facing, a tough crosswind caused by not only low prices, but really by the world's realization that it's got to back off fossil fuels. And the objection to this pipeline has been that in a period of low prices, the pipeline encourages expansion of tar sands, and that worsens the problem of climate change.
It also means that Keystone is not necessarily going to be this boon in employment that supporters of the project talk about, because it may be the case that it's just built but not used for a while, depending on the price of oil and what's profitable in terms of extracting this fossil fuel up in the tar sands.
Right. Well, as far as employment in the tar sands goes, that's stuck in a recession right now. The low price of tar sands, which tar sands oil is even cheaper than regular oil, has cut the expansion of the tar sands projects at its knees. And so in Canada, there's not a lot of hope for growing jobs in that enterprise. As far as the Keystone goes in the U.S., well, that's a few thousand jobs each summer while they build the pipeline over 2 years. It didn't look like that was going to start next year anyway. So from TransCanada's perspective, might as well see if you can punt and get away from a decision right now. Hope for something better in the years ahead.
Does it indicate the overall weakness in the political situation for Keystone that landowners in the state of Nebraska can shut this whole thing down?
You know, the landowners there have really been the forefront of the fight against Keystone since the beginning. They didn't want the pipeline, many of them, coming across their land. They didn't want the risks to the very sensitive ecosystem up there that the possibility of a spill held. And so they were the first ones to fight it. Now the decision that the president makes is mainly about climate change and about the fact that this project locks in a big, expensive infrastructure project that encourages carbon emissions for the next 40 or 50 years, when it's the policy of the U.S. government and most governments in the world to move in the opposite direction, to be investing in projects that reduce our carbon emissions dramatically for the next 50 years.
As someone who's followed this closely, how would you describe the change over the last 2 years? This was a real brinksmanship project where political supporters and political opponents were going to shoot out in the OK Corral over all of this. Now it really seems to be the momentum is in a state that even if there's a Republican president, it wouldn't necessarily mean that Keystone is going to survive.
Well, any Republican president that I can think of would probably approve this project in a heartbeat. And what they would be doing is opening the way for TransCanada to make a risky decision in an investment that could ultimately end up being stranded, because the tar sands expansion that was the supposition for this whole project for decades is put in jeopardy if the world decides that it wants to take climate change seriously. The tar sands expansion in Canada has been the single reason that Canada is unable to meet its own carbon dioxide targets.
Jack, thanks so much.
Glad to be with you.
Jack Cushman is a writer for Inside Climate News and author of Keystone and Beyond, Tar Sands and the National Interest in the Era of Climate Change. Thank you so much, Jack.
You're welcome.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Let's just say the Democratic front runner has been loosening up.
You just have to let them hear you roar. Katy Perry, thank you for being here.
Sympathetic appearances on college campuses, rising poll numbers, the town forum later this week in which her opponent, Bernie Sanders, is expected, as usual, not to attack her. And let's just say, despite the excitement of his campaign, Senator Bernie, with his rumpled look, doesn't quite have the put-together image of Hillary Clinton, the former Secretary of State, Senator, and First Lady. Her secret? Well, she may have let that out of the bag a few years back at a fashion event where she told Andy Cohen, a Bravo host, that she plans to live or die by her personal fashion statement, the blade creased and colorful pantsuit.
I am going to be pitching Andy and others on a new show for Bravo to sort of fill that gap that is so apparent to some of us. And we could call it Project Pantsuit.
Hey, she brought it up there. God forbid I focus on the fashion details of the most successful female candidate for president in U.S. history. Well, this Friday, the stage of Winthrop University in Rock Hill, South Carolina, will be the site of a broadcast on MSNBC with the three remaining Democratic candidates. Three candidates, two suits, and one pantsuit. It's a political equation that can only be solved or illuminated by Robin Givhan, Pulitzer Prize-winning fashion editor for The Washington Post and author of The Battle of Versailles, The Night American Fashion Stumbled into the Spotlight and Made History. Pantsuits, she says, are history, but in a good way.
It wasn't until 1993 that women could wear trousers on the Senate floor. When you look at Hillary Clinton's sort of evolution in both deciding to wear trousers publicly and becoming ever more comfortable with that decision, I think you sort of see, you know, an almost a history of how professional women have changed on the public stage.
Hillary Clinton in this discussion is a pretty special case in that because she's a collaborator with Bill Clinton in the highest level of politics, a kind of, you know, sexless femininity and success story that I'm going to get slapped around for suggesting, even though she's a very heroic woman because she's very much a figure of feminineness without necessarily being a sexual figure. And the pantsuit is right there at the center of all of that.
Well, you know, by the time Hillary Clinton first started wearing pantsuits, you know, she was still First Lady. And it was almost as if she just, you could almost hear this sigh of relief when she finally said, you know, enough with these pink skirt suits and headbands. And when she ran for Senate, she focused on solely a black pantsuit. That became her uniform. It essentially gave her the same kind of freedom that a dark suit gives men, which is that it took the conversation of clothing off the table. And when she ran for president the first time and had that rainbow of pantsuits, you know, I think to some degree she was again sort of struggling with this idea of power and femininity and how much can I embrace being a woman and declare that as part of my campaign. So when you, you know, sort of describe her as quote-unquote sexless, you know, I don't think that that is true. I think that what you're probably responding to is a very complicated tension between how much of her femininity and her sexuality is she going to be allowed to bring to the public stage?
Well, I think my reference there was more to their relationship than to her personally, but either one is subject to, you know, dispute and discussion. Can you explain how pants became pants suits? I mean, first there were pants, I believe, then there were pants suits. Where does this come from?
The history of pants or pantsuits really begins in terms of fashion somewhere around the 1950s, 1940s, when designers like Chanel, for instance, started to put women in trousers. And some of this came about because Chanel, for instance, was a bit of a sportswoman and was also very much opposed to this idea that women had to be uncomfortable and sort of trussed up in their daily lives. But it was really, I would say, Yves Saint Laurent who not only popularized trousers for women, but really popularized them in a way that allowed a particular social class of women to embrace them. And, you know, when he did that and you have these women who were sort of the doyens of society, who were dictating the rules of dress to other women, he really sort of unleashed a bit of a rebellion.
You know, if you think about women world leaders, and I have limited vocabulary here, but Benazir Bhutto, for instance, comes from Pakistan where female clothing is very uniform, even though it is very feminine, and there's not a lot of range. Maggie Thatcher seems to be a more extreme version of what Hillary's gone through in the United States, but doesn't necessarily give us any hint of what is to come. If Hillary Clinton made it into the White House, what do designers say about what that would mean in terms of advancing the idea of comfortable women's clothing and exciting fashion?
I think that is the great question of, you know, what does female power at that level look like in reality, you know, not in some Hollywood version of it? I don't think the fashion industry really knows what that looks like. I think that many designers, whether it's Michael Kors, for instance, have had this fantasy of what it looks like, but you don't really have a sense of what it will look like in reality. And I think it will be certainly interesting to see, but I think it will be a lesson in how we view women.
Robin Givhan, once again reminding us why she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning fashion editor for The Washington Post, author of The Battle of Versailles, The Night American Fashion Stumbled into the Spotlight and Made History. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this before we go. 20 years ago, I got off a plane from my honeymoon in Hawaii, and while rolling through the O'Hare Airport in Chicago, tanned and just emerging from a bubble of ignoring everything going on in the world for weeks, except perhaps the World Series, Atlanta beat Cleveland in 1995, I glanced over at the newsstand and saw in huge headline type, "Rabin killed by shooter." A Jewish extremist had killed the leader of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, claiming that his overtures to the Palestinians and his handshake with Yasser Arafat, the leader of the PLO, were justification for his death. Rabin, warrior, patriot, peacemaker, Israeli-born leader, hero of the 67 war, deemed an enemy of Israel by a domestic terrorist. Rabin once told me in an interview that in Israel you campaign about war and eventually learn to govern by finding a path to peace. That simple, I asked. No, 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 he laughed. In Israel, there are no straight paths. 20 years later, it's still true. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening.
It's a
support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.